So this is Majjhima Nikaya 117, known as the Great 40. There is actually this. The way I'm going to do the sutta reading is a bit unusual from what maybe we normally do, because one of the reasons I have picked out this particular sutta is that it has some strange idiosyncrasies in it. And what I want to show is that even with the discourses from the Pali, sometimes there are things that actually distort the meaning of the sutta. And I want to show you two ways in which the meaning of suttas can be distorted in particular. And that's one of the reasons I want to read this particular sutta. Because it's important to always take into account the Buddha's teaching about investigating and looking at things, and to make sure that what we actually see is what we hear is actually the truth, is actually proper. And the famous advice, of course, is the advice to the Kalamas, which probably all of you know, the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha said you shouldn't just take on tradition because it's tradition. You shouldn't just follow a teacher because he's respected. You shouldn't just do things because somebody else has said so, but you should always investigate for yourself. And only when you know for yourself that something works, that it is proper, that it gives rise to wholesome states, that it reduces unwholesome states, only then should you accept it and should you follow it. And this is the same thing, of course, for the Buddha's teachings. And it is particularly so for the suttas that we find in the Pali Canon, because these suttas are 2,500 years old. And of course, it's quite possible that there are some distortions in there. You don't know what's happened in over 2,500 years. Things may have changed. Things may have somehow gotten distorted over that period of time. And there's two particular distortions I want to point out which are possible. And this comes up in this particular sutta. Now, the first type of distortion, which I'm going to talk about first, is that very often when we read the suttas, we actually rely on the commentaries. We rely on literature, which came hundreds of years after the Buddha, to actually understand the suttas. And you will see that even when you read this translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, if you have a doubt about what something means in these suttas, what you often do is you look up the notes at the back, right? Now, if you know the notes at the back, you will realize that many of the notes in the back are actually taken from the commentaries. So if you read the notes in the back and you interpret the suttas according to the notes in the back, essentially you're reading the suttas through the commentaries. So if the commentaries don't explain the sutta properly, you can actually get a distorted view of what is in the sutta. And this is one of the things I want to show through this sutta today, because there's one particular point here which, in my opinion, can give quite a distorted and wrong impression of what the suttas are saying. So that is one thing, the danger of reading the suttas through the commentary. Another thing is the fact that sometimes the suttas themselves actually have material which is added to them, which is extraneous. And the way you can find that out is by doing comparative studies of suttas in different recensions. There is a monk in Germany who I have corresponded with a little bit, and he is actually doing a comparative study of the Majjhima Nikaya, and he's comparing it to the Madhyama Agama, which is the Chinese version of the Majjhima Nikaya, and it comes from a different lineage than the Theravadins. It comes from a Sarvastivadin lineage. So this is basically a branch off from the Theravadins, which happened about 200 to 300 years after the Buddha passed away. And when you compare these different recensions of the suttas, you can see that sometimes there are discrepancies. 99% of the time, they almost match each other perfectly. And that's one of the reasons I have such faith that what we read in the Pali Canon basically is the word of the Buddha, because the change is so little over the centuries. But occasionally you come across important differences. And there is such an important difference in this sutta. The way I interpret that difference is that something actually has been added to this particular sutta. So I wanted to make these two particular points. And I think it is important, because it's important not to be have too much faith. It's important to have faith, but it's important to have wise faith. Important to have faith in the right place, and to know what is the the stronger, the clear word of the Buddha, which is basically indisputably goes back to the, seems to go back to the Buddha anyway, and which is more doubtful. So I will get to these points as I go through the sutta. So now I will just start to read, and I will bring up these points as we go along here. Okay, so the great 40, Majjhima Nikaya 117. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park, which is where the Buddha pretty much was living most of the time. There he addressed the monks, the bhikkhus, thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, I shall teach you noble right concentration with its supports and its requisites. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, venerable sir," the bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this, "What, bhikkhus, is noble right concentration with its supports and its requisites? That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness. Unification of mind equipped with these seven factors is called noble right concentration with its supports and requisites." Okay, I'm going to stop there for a while. The first thing that you note here is that there is an unusual term here, and this term is noble right concentration. Normally we just hear about right concentration, which is samasamadhi. That is the standard term in the suttas. And samasamadhi, of course, is always in the suttas, always defined as the four jhanas. It is the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, and it's always the four jhanas. So here we have something which is slightly different, and this is called noble right concentration, arya samasamadhi in the Pali. And because it's not exactly the same as samasamadhi, you also see here that the definition of it is slightly different from ordinary. It's not actually defined here as the four jhanas, but it's defined as unification of mind, which is has as its support and requisites the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is interesting because in the commentaries, this particular type of samadhi for this sutta is actually defined as something different. Something completely different. It's a new terminology that the commentaries actually use to define this samasamadhi. And I will get back to that in a second. But first of all, I just wanted to give you the interpretation, which I think is the most suitable one for this noble right concentration. And the clue here is that noble right concentration is endowed with the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Now, if you, I don't know how well you know the suttas, but the person who is endowed with the Noble Eightfold Path, that's a sotapanna, the one who has attained the first stage of enlightenment. He is said in the sutta in the Sanghutta Nikaya, in the Sotapatti Sanghutta actually. He's actually said to be the sotapanna. He or she is said to be endowed with the Noble Eightfold Path. So the Arya Samasamadhi, I therefore take to be the Samasamadhi or the right concentration of the person who is an Arya, in other words, somebody who is on at least the first stage of enlightenment. And that's why I say it's also the reason why it is called Arya Samasamadhi, precisely because it is the Samasamadhi of the Arya. Alternatively, and this might be just as good an explanation, it simply means the right concentration of somebody who's practicing the Eightfold Path properly here. In other words, it just means somebody who's practicing properly, doing all the steps as they should be done, and that person is said, when they attain jhanas, it's said to be noble samasamadhi here, because they're practicing the path properly here. And later on in the sutta, we come to the definition of right view. And the way that right view is defined here is defined in such a way that it seems to include basically people who are not only Aryas, but also ordinary people. because it's defined as what is often called mundane right view, ordinary right view of ordinary people. So that is why I think maybe this is what is meant in this particular sutta. It's just the right concentration of somebody who is practicing the path properly here. You might ask the question, well, what about somebody who doesn't practice the path properly? Can they even attain right samadhi? Can they even attain sama samadhi? And that's a good question, because normally you wouldn't be able to if you don't practice the path properly here. But sometimes you might have people who are very gifted from a past life, for example, have practiced samadhi in a past life, and for that reason have very strong gifts in samatha. And it is actually possible that even if you don't practice the other seven factors properly, you may not be all that virtuous, all that good, but because of those paramis from a past life, you may actually occasionally still be able to get into deep samadhi, more like because of your past life experiences. But that would not then be Arya Sama Samadhi, because that would not be based on the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So that is the way I understand it from the suttas. That is the meaning of Noble Eightfold, of Noble Right Concentration. It just means the right concentration of somebody who practices it properly. And then the question, of course, is, well, what exactly, what is the content of this right concentration? Because it says here that it just means unification of mind with the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path as its requisites. What is the meaning of this unification of mind? And I say it means the jhanas. It means the jhanas because there is another place in the Anguttara Nikaya 5, which states that Arya Sama Samadhi is the four jhanas plus something else, which is called the Pachavekana Nimitta, which is like the sign of reflection almost. But that is actually a stage after the jhanas. So the essential meaning of this Arya Sama Samadhi, according to this sutta, is the jhanas. But the point here, the reason why it's called Arya Sama Samadhi and not just Sama Samadhi, is that it is supported by these other seven factors. Okay, so that's what I understand it to mean according to the suttas. Now I'm going to explain to you what the commentary says it means, because this is quite different. To understand this is that when you look up the commentary, I don't even think they have it here, actually, Nova Mara, but in the monastery we have the commentaries. When you look up the commentary, it says that the meaning of Arya Sama Samadhi is something they called Magga Samadhi. And Magga Samadhi is also another term for that, is something called Lokuttara Jhana. Lokuttara Jhana is another word for that. And this Lokuttara Jhana, or Magga Samadhi, actually is not a samadhi in the ordinary sense at all. What it is one of the four stages of enlightenment, the moment that you attain one of the four stages of enlightenment. Because according to the Abhidhamma of the Theravadan school, at the moment you attain one of the four stages of enlightenment, the jhana factors are also present. Right? So in other words, this thing called Magga Samadhi, or Lokuttara Jhana, is a combination of enlightenment experience and also an experience of the jhanas. It is a combination of that. And that is why it is called Lokuttara Jhana. Lokuttara Jhana literally means, Lokuttara means beyond the world. In other words, supramundane is often translated. And jhana is just jhana. But because here in the Abhidhamma, it's actually no longer jhana in the ordinary sense, it is a combination of jhana and an experience of enlightenment. That's what it means according to the Abhidhamma. So what happens then is that the Abhidhamma comes up with this new idea called Lokuttara Jhana. And then, of course, the name Lokuttara Jhana, straight away it gives a sense of jhana because the word jhana is in there. And then the commentaries take this new concept, which is actually first encountered in the Abhidhamma. Now, of course, the Abhidhamma is later than the suttas. It's about 200 or 300 years after the suttas. And then the commentaries take this concept, and it says that a particular instance in the suttas, where the suttas say Sama Samadhi or Jhana, the commentary says this means Lokuttara Jhana. Right? So the commentary is reading the suttas in terms of the Abhidhamma. it is using an Abhidhamma concept to explain the suttas. Now, this Abhidhamma concept is completely different. It's never actually seen in the suttas at all. You don't see this Abhidhamma concept in the suttas. And yet the commentary explains the suttas in terms of the Abhidhamma. So what this means is that this concept in the Abhidhamma of Lokuttara Jhana or Magga Samadhi, now the Abhidhamma is a very different type of work than the suttas from the suttas. Because the Abhidhamma is about describing reality here. So the Abhidhamma has this large enumeration of factors that make up the world, how the world is constructed here. The Abhidhamma also has the sense of momentariness. It talks about momentary events. Because the point of the Abhidhamma is the descriptive thing. It describes reality. So it wants to break down reality in the smallest possible units and terms, right? So because of that, it talks about momentary events. And it talks about the breakdown of reality. So when the Abhidhamma has this concept of Lokuttara Jhana, that is a momentary event. It's the moment, the precise moment when somebody experiences, has an experience of enlightenment. That's what this Lokuttara Jhana is. So when the commentary then says that Arya Samma Samadhi, in this case, means Lokuttara Jhana, is talking about a momentary event of realization and not about jhanas anymore. And you will, when you start reading the suttas more widely and you check what the commentary says, it's not only in this instance, but it's in many, many instances in the suttas you find that when the suttas talk about jhana or Samma Samadhi, the commentary explains it as Lokuttara Jhana or Magga Samadhi, which basically is the same thing. So what is, in a sense it is doing here, it is moving the idea away from ordinary Samadhi Jhana towards a momentary experience, which is an Abhidhamma concept. In the suttas, everything is about the practice. It's pragmatic, it's practical, it's about the path. It's about how we get to enlightenment, right? That's the whole purpose of the suttas. It's about the path of practice. That's what the suttas is about. The Abhidhamma, on the other hand, is about the description of reality. It's how the world can be described. And here, the commentary is then understanding the practice in terms of Abhidhamma. So it's moving away from the practical aspects and moving it towards a description of reality instead. And by doing that, it's distorting the teachings of the Buddha. It's saying that the jhanas are not actually jhanas here. They're actually realizations of enlightenment. And by doing that, what that results in, it results in the fact that the jhanas, seen from the commentaries, are no longer necessary here. Because if the jhana is equivalent to a moment of enlightenment, then of course, if jhana is necessary for the path, the commentary will say, well, that jhana which is necessary for the path is just that moment of enlightenment. Because that's called jhana according to the commentary here. So you can see how by looking at it in this way, you're actually taking away the necessity of jhana because you are calling it enlightenment rather than calling it jhana. So that's what's happening here. And this is the sort of thing you have to be careful about, because if you read this sutta here, and I'm going to just briefly look up the comment at the back, which is put in there by Venerable Bodhi. And this is note 1099 in the sutta, and it says here, the Pali is Arya Samma Samadhi Sa Upanisa Saparikara, in other words, noble right concentration, with its causes and with its requisites. And the commentary explained here as means noble here is supramundane. In other words, supramundane has, in other words, it has to do with attainment of the status of enlightenment. And says that this is the concentration pertaining to the supramundane paths. So in other words, in this case, according to commentary, it refers to the attainment of enlightenment and not to samadhi in its ordinary state. I don't know how clear that was. I must admit, it's difficult to explain it in such brief, so briefly. But my point is basically here that sometimes, if you read the commentaries, you can get a distorted idea of what the suttas are saying. That's basically the idea here. Does anybody want to say anything about that before we move on, maybe? Yeah. Okay, well, the commentaries were basically they were compiled by Venerable Buddha Gosa about 500, about 1,000 years after the Buddha. But many of those commentaries were more ancient than that. So some people say that the core of the commentaries probably came all the way from the time of the Buddha. And then they were slowly accumulated and became larger and larger and larger. And I think the important point here is that most of the commentarial stuff is probably perfectly okay here. A lot of it is just explaining background to things, you know, and that sort of stuff, explaining who a particular person was. And all that is obviously not, you know, is okay here. But occasionally you come across things which clearly goes, you know, goes against the suttas. And the problem is that nobody really knows exactly who wrote the commentaries. It's uncertain. And because it is uncertain, that's why you have to be careful with the material which is in there. If you're a Buddhist, well, basically your faith is placed in the Buddha, what the Buddha said. Because he was enlightened, and he is the originator of the whole path, that's where you start placing your faith. And what anybody else says, it may be right, but it may also be wrong here. And that's why you have to be so careful with it. The commentaries, actually, they continue even written up to this day, actually. There's still people writing commentaries to this day. So you find sub-commentaries on certain things. And you find still people writing Pali commentaries around the world. Yeah. Okay, well, basically, it's like anything which is leads out of samsara, if you like. Anything to do with nibbana, anything to do with... that's why the stages of enlightenment are called supramundane, because they actually lead you away from samsara, right? They have nibbana as an object. You realize, you know, when you first see the Dhamma as a sotapanna, you basically realize that the entire world is suffering. That's one of the profound insights. So it leads you away from rebirth. That's what supramundane means. Leads away from samsara. Beyond the ordinary, beyond the world, I think is supposed to be the meaning here. But I think ordinary is not a very good translation for mundane in this sense, because it includes all of samsara, right? Including the jhana realms and everything. But it's just they have just used that terminology to make a distinction between that which has to do with nibbana and that which has to do with rebirth. Supramundane. No, I think you find it. I think you might find it in a dictionary if you look it up. Any other questions, sir? Okay. Okay. So I'll move on a little bit, having done that very tiny little part. Okay. Then we come to the section on view. So now the sutta is going to go from having just explained what noble right concentration is, now the sutta is going to explain each of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, or at least the first five, I think it is. So the first one here is view. So therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. So, in other words, to even be able to start on the Noble Eightfold Path, you have to be able to understand what is right view and what is wrong view. If you can't understand that, well, then you are in trouble, basically. That's why right view comes first. So, in other words, when you go around and you hear various teachings, you hear various people saying this, saying that, you're actually able to pick out which teachings are proper, which teachings are good, which teachings are aligned with right view and which ones are not. And that is your right view. In other words, if there's a spark of wisdom in there already from the beginning. Haven't got that spark of wisdom, then it gets very difficult. It's unfair, isn't it? Okay. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong view? So this is then the definition, standard definition of wrong view in the suttas. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions, nor this world, nor other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is wrong view. Now, this is a standard description of wrong view in the suttas, and this is a kind of view that is applicable not only to Aryas, in other words, those who have experienced this, at least one of the stages of enlightenment, but this is applicable to anybody here, putujanas, ordinary people, just anybody here. So that's why it's called mundane right view, because you can have this sort of right view at any stage on the path. So just to go through it in more detail, the first thing here, there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Well, this just means that there is no good karma to be gained from giving, from dana, from generosity, from sacrificing. Yeah. That's basically the meaning here. So in other words, you are repudiating the law of karma. You're saying there is no karma. Yeah. There is no fruit or result of good and bad actions. Again, whether you are virtuous or not virtuous doesn't make any difference, because there is no karmic effect from being virtuous and being kind. That's what fruit and results here, vipaka, of good and bad actions. There is no this world, and there is no other world. What this means, apparently, and it makes good sense, is that there is, there is no rebirth in different worlds. In other words, you are a nihilist in the sense that you don't believe that there is a life after you die. That's it. It's a nihilistic kind of conception. So you don't go from this world to another world, nor do you go from another world back to this world. In other words, you're basically denying the doctrine of rebirth here. No mother, no father. Again, this obviously doesn't mean literally what it says, but it means that there is no responsibility towards mother or father, or there is no karmic effect of acting good, well, or acting badly, or acting with a good way towards your parents. There is no karmic effect of that. That's basically what it means here. So all of this is about karma, rebirth and karma, really. Yeah? Then there are no beings who are reborn spontaneously. Yeah? This means that you don't really believe in things like devas, because devas have a usually spontaneous rebirth. Spontaneous means that you're not born in the ordinary sense like humans, but you just re-arise spontaneously in the devaloka. And there are also other beings which are reborn spontaneously. Beings in the hell realms are supposed to be reborn spontaneously. There are also some beings in the lower realms, like ghosts, can be reborn spontaneously. And according to one sutta, I don't know how reliable it is or whatever, but I think we should take it seriously because it is in the sutta. Even some human beings can be reborn spontaneously, says this sutta. That's interesting. And it's a sort of thing you wonder whether it actually what it means. And I can think of a couple of maybe explanations how human beings can be reborn spontaneously. It's just a bit of a side issue, really, but it might be interesting anyway. And for those of you who know the suttas quite well, you will know that the human lifespan goes in cycles. And it goes in cycles according to this, the Aganya Sutta, Digha Nikaya 27, I think it is, and another sutta just before it. Human lifespan goes from a minimum of 10 years all the way up to 84,000 years. It goes in these enormous cycles, and it goes down again, up again, like that, in cycles. And, of course, when the lifespan of a human being is 84,000 years, then it can't really have a human body like we have now. If you have this human body living for 84,000 years, it's pretty much unimaginable. It would be pretty terrible state, I think, even after a few hundred years, let alone 84,000 years. So I think that what you have, my assumption there is that when a human being lives for 84,000 years, they actually have a much more refined and subtle body than we have now, basically. And that kind of body might be more similar to devas, and therefore it may be a body which is subject to spontaneous rebirth rather than to ordinary rebirth. So that is what I think may be the most likely explanation. There are a couple of other explanations, or at least one more explanation as well, which I have thought of, but I don't really know how. I think that's probably enough. I think that's the most likely one here. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Indeed, yeah, 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 yeah. I think, yeah. I think where it leaves you is that the first issue here is basically, instead of, you know, right view is a relative thing. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you take it on board 100%. You know, in Christianity, belief is really a misnomer for what they do in Christianity or any other, most other religions. Belief means actually taking it as 100% true, doesn't it? I believe in God. Doesn't mean that, yeah, maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't. It means you have a firm conviction that there is a God, right? But in Buddhism, belief actually, I think, means what it means. And right view means that you, in balance, you're willing to take it on board as what I would call a working hypothesis, that there is another world, that there is rebirth, that there is karma, because that's presumably what the Buddha said. And also you find people who practice very hard even to this day, monks and nuns, or even some lay people, who can actually see these things. And because of that, there is a good reason to assume that that these things are actually exist. And then as you practice, or as you read the suttas, and as you do all these things, that view will either get strengthened or it will get weakened. Right? And that is part of what this is all about. This establishing right view is about investigating for yourself and practicing and then finding out more and more whether this actually accords with reality or it doesn't. And then the view will get strengthened. But there is no absolute right view or wrong view in Buddhism the same way as there is in Christianity. It's a relative thing. Something which can get stronger and stronger, or something which can get weaker and weaker. And you just have to practice with it to the best of your ability. And then one day, hopefully, you will find out for yourself whether there is such a thing or not, you know. Obviously not easy. Most people will never find out. But that's the ideal, is to find out for yourself. Yeah. So, but wrong view is like rejecting it, right? Out of hand. That's wrong view, Now, most people will be stationed somewhere between right view and wrong view. They won't be 100% convinced one way or the other, right? They'll be somewhere in between. So the point here is to get the closer you can get to the right view end of the spectrum, the better. So maybe you can be 60% convinced that there is rebirth, right? Or maybe 50%, or maybe 80%. But the point is don't be 0%, because you just don't know what's going to happen afterwards. If you're 0% convinced that there is no rebirth, well, then you got wrong view, huh? Yeah, precisely. You can't, indeed. That's why you have to have an open mind, you know? You have to have an open mind. You shouldn't actually go around saying, I'm absolutely sure that there is rebirth, because unless you have seen it for yourself, because you can't. Indeed. Yeah. Ten years, they say in the suttas. 10 years is the shortest lifespan there. Supposedly, previous Buddhas came when there were longer lifespans for human beings. So I guess it just depends. You know, exactly why he comes at a particular time, I'm not sure. But presumably, you know, it was a good time to come. Maybe there were many people who were ready to understand the Dhamma or whatever. I don't know her. But it's interesting because one of the differences between the time, the long lifetimes, is that at that time, people seem to be much more virtuous in those when there's very long lifespans. Because you can imagine it takes a lot more good karma to get reborn into a lifespan of 60,000 years than it takes to get reborn into a lifespan of 80 years like we have now. So because of that, people needed a lot more virtue to get reborn there, and then they will naturally be more virtuous when they're there. And because of that, those Buddhas, that actually many of them didn't even lay down any Vinaya rules. So there were no Vinaya rules, and they didn't teach very much either. It was often just maybe a direct dialogue between disciple and master. So for that reason, many of those dispensations or sasanas, they actually lasted for a very short time, according to the traditional story which is found in the Vinaya. Whereas the advantage with this dispensation is that it lasts for many, many, many generations. You know, how many generations have we had now since the Buddha passed away? Maybe 250 generations or something like that, you know? Lots and lots of generations. So there is some advantage with a shorter lifespan as well. Yeah. Yes. It's difficult to say because it doesn't really give a very clear correlation between the universe contracting, expanding, and the life cycle of humans. It doesn't give a correlation between that. So I would say that even within one expansion, one contraction of the universe, there can still be a lot of ups and downs for the human lifespan. That's the way it seems. So I think these are just natural cycles in the universe. You know, there's natural cycles happening, basically. Yes, yeah. Indeed, that's true. So, but again, there is two types of right view, right? And this here is the ordinary right view. And this right view, to a large extent, you can have even if there isn't Buddhism in the world. Because you can still, people even before the Buddha had faith that there was such a thing as rebirth, that there was karma and these things. But it's really the higher right view, the right view of actually seeing the Four Noble Truths. That's the highest right view. That is the one which you cannot have if there is no Buddha in the world. Okay, so that was the no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. So this basically means that you have no faith that there are some people who are wise and who have understood something profoundly in a way that we haven't understood it. So this is like not having a teacher, basically, not being able to accept anybody who knows something and who have seen something you haven't seen. For example, it means not believing, not having any faith that there is a Buddha, that there can be a Buddha in the world. So this is a wrong view. Now comes a second part here, second aspect. And what, bhikkhus, is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. And there is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. Okay, so this is already controversial, what has just been stated there. But I will just read the rest of this before I comment on that. And what, bhikkhus, is right view that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? There is what is given, and what is offered, and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is right view, affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. So right view here is exactly the opposite of what we saw before was wrong view. And that is the first type of right view that they are mentioning here. And the second type of right view is as follows. And what, bhikkhus, is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the investigation of states, enlightenment factor, the path factor of right view in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. Okay, now here, this is interesting, particularly the last paragraph there is quite stands out. And it is indeed this last paragraph, which is right here, is the only place in the suttas that you find this particular paragraph. And that already makes it a little bit, makes it unusual already. Many people have often said that, well, it's those things that you see again and again in the suttas. It is those things in particular that you can be quite sure of is the word of the Buddha, because you see it again and again in the suttas. Now this, as I said, this particular paragraph here, you only see once, and it's in this sutta. That is the first strange thing about this paragraph. Now the second strange thing about this paragraph is, I will just read again what it says here, the wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the investigation of states, enlightenment factor, the path factor of right view, etc. Now that paragraph there is almost a direct copy of what you find in one of the Abhidhamma books called the Vibhanga. So it looks like it's almost been copied out of this particular book, the Vibhanga, and placed into this sutta. That would have to be the conclusion if you read this and you compare it to the Abhidhamma. It's not so clear here for right view, but later on when you come to right intention, right action, right speech, and right livelihood, it's even more clear that it is copied out of the Abhidhamma, because it's word for word, this long series of word, which is a very specific Abhidhamma approach to the Dhamma, you find in the suttas in exactly the same way. So the feeling about this whole paragraph is one of Abhidhamma. Now there is more things here which are a little bit strange, and that is, if you go back to the paragraph before, it says there about the right view, ordinary right view, and it says right view that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, right? Ripening in the acquisitions basically means that this sort of right view leads to rebirth. That's essentially what that means, that phrase there. It's affected by the taints. In other words, it's affected by the asavas. Partaking of merit, again, in other words, it has to do with kamma and rebirth rather than being a practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Now that is in great contrast to how the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are talked about elsewhere. Everywhere else, the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, including right view, which we're talking about now, are said to lead to the end of suffering, to enlightenment, to the ending of acquisitions, to the ending of rebirth. That's what it leads to. So the phrasing here is almost the opposite of what you normally find about these factors on the path. So that's why this becomes very interesting. And I say again, it looks like it's been taken directly out of the Abhidhamma and just placed into the sutta. Now, as I mentioned before, there is this German monk who I have corresponded a little bit with, and he does this comparative study of the Chinese agamas with the Pali suttas. And when you read the agamas, this passage is missing in the agamas. In other words, it doesn't exist in the agamas. So, in other words, this is something which has appeared in the Pali, but does not exist in the Chinese agamas. And there is another small pointer of evidence that this may be a later insertion into the Pali Suttas. It wasn't there originally, but it only became to prominence when the Abhidhamma became very important, maybe 200 or 300 years after the Buddha, And then it may have been inserted into the sutta after that. So that whole section there about noble right view, that is taintless, supramundane, and the path factor, the wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, etc., that does not exist in the Chinese. So, I don't know what you make of all that, but I personally find it very fascinating, because all of these things are evidences to show that the suttas, even though, generally speaking, they're very trustworthy, occasionally you come across places where it looks like they have been changed over the centuries. So it's fascinating, yeah? Yes? Yeah.
My recollection is, does this ring a bell for you in your experience with those that whole idea of creating positive karmas, which then are stepping stone towards non-acquisition?
Right, I mean, it's true, it does. The point isn't that it does create good karma in a sense to have right view, obviously it does. But the point is that right view is here to ripen in the acquisition. In other words, it's like it's leading to acquisitions, right? But my point is only that, generally speaking, right view and all the eight factors are said to lead to the end of dukkha. That's the point of them. Okay, initially, yes, they create good karma, and they will lead to good rebirth if you don't go as far as to, you know, becoming a stream enter or whatever. But the point is that they're leading in that direction. So, you know, it's not as if they are leading. The point is that they're leading to going beyond the world. And that is the important point here. True, they lead to also to good rebirth if you don't get that far. But the point of it is that it goes all the way out of samsara. Now, this thing called supramundane right view, which is the sort of view which you attain when you become a sotapanna, of course it leads out of samsara, because at that point you have actually seen reality as it actually is. So that definitely leads out of samsara. But the other one does as well, because it's going in the right direction. Right? Yeah, I mean, it is quite complicated, because there is in the suttas also a different type of right view, which is the supramundane right view. That is the view of the Four Noble Truths, right? There's the knowledge of suffering, the knowledge of the origin of suffering, the knowledge of the ending of suffering, knowing of the path leading to the end of suffering. That is a standard description of supramundane right view, if you like, in the suttas.
Is that the same as the second paragraph?
No, it's completely different. Because... The supramundane right view in the suttas, that is the right view of a sotapanna. That's the right view of any of the Aryans, right? Any of the people who have attained one of the enlightenment. But that view is always present. It's a view which has become part of the makeup of the sotapanna, right? Now, this particular right view here is a momentary right view that arises only at the moment you attain one of the stages of enlightenment. That's why I say it's an Abhidhamma concept, which is completely alien to the suttas. The suttas don't talk about momentary things. They don't talk about describing reality in its minute constituent parts. That is an Abhidhamma thing to talk about that. And here, it's an Abhidhamma concept which is being brought into the suttas by saying that this right view is a momentary right view. Yes, there is supramundane right view, but it has a completely different, it's a different idea about it in the suttas than it is in the Abhidhamma. Well, it is momentary. If you take the Abhidhamma understanding of it, it's momentary. Yeah, and because this is imported from the Abhidhamma, you have to assume that it's a momentary, here it has a momentary meaning, yeah? Yeah. But the suttas don't talk about momentary things. This is one of the important differences between the suttas and the Abhidhamma, huh? Yeah. Yeah, that is true. I mean, in a sense, it is true. It's just that, because the difference there is the difference between the Aryans and the non-Aryans, right? And the Aryans, they have the right view is fixed because they have seen reality as it actually is. They know where suffering is, they know where non-suffering is. So their view will be completely purified, if you like. So that's true. And then there is the view which comes before that, which is the view of ordinary people. But the point I'm making here is that even the view of ordinary people, if it is right view, it is leading in the right direction. And if you keep practicing according to it, it will eventually lead to Nibbana. Right? So it is actually going in the direction of Nibbana. Even the ordinary right view is going that direction. But here, they are saying that it ripens in acquisitions, it ripens in rebirth, what they're saying here. Whereas in other suttas, the common way it's mentioned, it actually says it leads to the ending of suffering, this type of view. That's the distinction I'm making here. There is no other place in the suttas that right view is described in this particular way, nor any of the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Sure, it's true. No, that's true. Because the difference is that if you haven't seen it, you are relying on your own intellect, your own thinking, basically, to a large extent. You know, you're relying on something, on your own karma from the past, relying on all these things. That view isn't certain yet. It's not sure. It depends on conditions, basically. Whereas the other view, it is a direct insight into reality. Because it's a direct insight to reality, it is you know it. It's not something that doesn't rely anymore on conditions outside of you, because you have seen something which then makes it permanent. So it's in a sense it's unconditioned, in the sense that it just sits. It becomes a permanent part of you. So right view, when it becomes the view of a sotapanna, essentially it becomes part of the makeup of the person. You can't get rid of it anymore. Because you can't get rid of it anymore, you have to practice according to the Noble Eightfold Path. You can't avoid it. It's like this idea of a child or anybody touching a hot plate, right? When it's really hot, you automatically withdraw your hand when you touch the hot plate. And the same thing with the sotapanna. Because he's right view, then he won't do bad actions, because it's like a hot plate. He knows that this is leading in the wrong way. In the same way, you won't touch the hot plate, and any area will not tend to do bad karma. It's just like that. Just like you withdraw from the hot plate. Okay. Let's move on there. Okay, so those were the two points I wanted to make out today, basically. The two most important ones, that you have to be careful with the commentaries, because sometimes they can distort the meaning of the suttas. And you also have to be careful with the actual contents of the suttas themselves sometimes. But sometimes you can have insertions. And these things particularly come out when you do comparative studies of the suttas. Okay, so we're getting to paragraph 9. It says here that one makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. This is one's right effort. So the point here It's a little bit strange. Right effort usually is connected with virtue, right? You make an effort to be virtuous. But here you actually have the effort to have right view. And the way I understand this is simply that you investigate, you look at things. When somebody tells you that there is rebirth, instead of just rejecting it right away, maybe you read the suttas more, maybe you speak to other people who have seen things you haven't. And then by investigating it, you are making an effort to move in the direction of right view. And then after a while, the more you investigate it, the more you contemplate it, the more easy often it becomes to accept that this is a possibility. This is a way the world may actually be in this way. Mindfully, one abandons wrong view. Mindfully, one enters upon and abides in right view. That is one's right mindfulness. The point here is, of course, that instead of just having a muddled mind with views and opinions just running around all the time, this seems to basically mean that you know what's happening inside your mind. You know what sort of views you have, and you know when you want to abandon something which is wrong, then you actually know that you realize that this is wrong, and then you change your mind about something when the right time has come to change your mind. And you do it mindfully rather than just all these views running around in the mind. Thus, these three states run and circle around right view. That is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. In other words, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness are the things which help you and sustains right view and makes right view grow. Okay, so that is the first factor of the path, right view. Now the next ones are much easier because the pattern is pretty much exactly the same for the next factors. So we've done most of the work already here. Okay, so the second factor, of course, is intention. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong intention as wrong intention and right intention as right intention. This is one's right view. And you notice the importance here is that you actually have to have right view before you can have right intention. In other words, if you are absolutely certain that there is no such thing as good and bad karma, that there is no rebirth, etc., then it's quite likely that you will just start to intend wrongly. You won't really care anymore about doing what is right and doing what is wrong. On the other hand, if you have right view, you have a very strong incentive, obviously, to have right intention, to intend for the happiness of yourself and for the happiness of others. I think that to some extent they have a right view actually, because and the reason I say that is because they believe in an afterlife, and many Christians will say that whether you go to heaven or you go to hell will depend on your actions. It's faith and actions are the two things which matter. So in a sense, you can say that there is a sense of karma and rebirth there already, even in the Christian faith. It's not obviously compatible with our view of it, but there is some aspect of it which is already there. So I would say that they have maybe partial right view. That would be what I would say there. And what bickers is wrong intention, the intention of sensual desire, the intention of ill will, and the intention of cruelty. This is wrong intention. So if you don't think that there is any bad consequences for anybody in being bad or being doing bad things, then might as well do it. And what bickers is right intention. Right intention, I say, is twofold. There is right intention that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, and there is right intention that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. And what bickers is right intention that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, the intention of renunciation, the intention of non-ill will, and the intention of non-cruelty. This is the intention this is right intention that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit and ripening in the acquisitions. So here you have intention of non-ill will, which is usually just another word for metta, and non-cruelty is usually another word for karuna or compassion. And what monks is right intention that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The thinking, thought, intention, mental absorption, mental fixity, directing of the mind, verbal formation, in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right intention that is noble, a factor of the path. Again, this whole sequence here from the thinking all the way to the verbal formation there is a direct copy of the Abhidhamma, of this book called the Vibhanga, and it just seems to be put in here. And again, this paragraph does not exist in the Chinese Agama. So again, it looks like it has been inserted into the sutta from the Abhidhamma. It's interesting here how they only talk about this noble right view as a factor of the path. You see, the last thing there is a factor of the path, maganga, whereas, of course, in the suttas, any of the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are the factors of the path. But this is a particular way of putting it, which is the Abhidhamic way of putting it. In other words, it's the path which is supramundane, is that precise moment of enlightenment which they're talking about here, which is very different from how the path is talked about in the suttas. In the suttas, the path is basically something you walk along, which goes over a long time. It's not momentary. Okay, one makes an effort to abandon wrong intention and to enter upon right intention. This is one's right effort. So here, basically, this is just a standard description of the four right efforts. So if you have some wrong thoughts or wrong ideas arising in your mind, then of course you put in right effort to abandon those wrong intentions, those intentions of cruelty and ill will, and you exert yourself to abandon that. And that is just right effort. So that's why right effort here becomes important. Mindfully one abandons wrong intention, mindfully one enters upon and abides in right intention. This is one's right mindfulness. So here the idea is, of course, that you, if when you are mindful, then you have much more chance of abandoning these bad intentions and giving rise to right intentions. And one reason is simply that if you have strong mindfulness, then you will catch any negative thoughts, any wrong thoughts, catch them very early before they get a very strong hold in the mind. The stronger the hold in the mind is, the more difficult it's going to be to abandon those wrong intentions. And the Buddha said that when something has gotten a really strong hold in the mind, it's very difficult to abandon it. So that's why it's important to catch it early, and that's why mindfulness becomes an important factor here in abandoning these things. And the other reason, obviously, is also simply because mindfulness just shows you that you know what you're doing. You're aware of what's happening in your mind at all times. Thus, these three states run and circle around right intention. That is, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. Right view gives rise to right intention. Right effort makes sure that you keep right intention in the mind. And right mindfulness also is part of the factor which makes sure that you're actually able to sustain that right mindfulness. That right intention. Yes? Nothing here. There's nothing there. The Agamas only have right view and wrong view in the ordinary sense. It doesn't have the supramundane one at all. Yes. Yeah. It doesn't have the supramundane phrasing at all. It doesn't have the phrasing of dukkha jnana, the knowledge of dukkha, dukkha samudaya jnana, which is the ordinary way that the suttas talk about the supramundane aspect of right view. It doesn't have that at all. It only has the mundane one. And then it has the ordinary expression for all the other factors as well. There's no supramundane factors there at all. Yes. That's right. Yeah. And it doesn't have that whole phrase about partaking in the acquisitions, ripening the acquisitions, partaking away. That phrase is also missing in the Agamas. Yeah. Okay. Right. Then we come to speech. There in Bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One who understands wrong view as wrong view and right speech as right speech. This is one's right view. So in other words, right view is what helps you to understand what is wrong and what is right. If you have got wrong view, you can't even tell the difference between wrong speech and right speech. So you don't understand that, being harsh, speaking harshly or speaking divisively or lying, you don't even understand that is wrong. And that's obviously, I think, one of the reasons why many people use wrong language, because they just don't have enough right view to even understand that this is wrong. And that, of course, that makes it very, very difficult then to teach them to live a moral life, because you have no grasp there of what is right and what is wrong in the first place. Your view is so distorted, basically. So that's why you can see that it's actually, even if you sometimes have, use wrong speech, at least you have the right view is taking you at least in the right direction. That's why right view is so important. The foundation is there, so there's actually some hope that you will move in the right way when it comes to right speech. If you haven't got the foundation, there is no hope of moving the right way here. And that's why right view is said to be the most important factor in making good and bad karma, because you're completely blocked off from doing the right thing if your view is completely wrong here. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong speech? False speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, and gossip. This is wrong speech. I'm not going to go into any detail with that today, because that's really a subject for a different talk, I think. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech? Right speech, I say, is twofold. There is right speech that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. And there is right speech that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? Abstinence from false speech, abstinence from malicious speech, abstinence from harsh speech, abstinence from gossip. This is right speech that is affected by taints, ripening in the acquisitions. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The desisting from the four kinds of verbal misconduct, the abstaining, refraining, abstinence from them, in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path, and is developing the noble path. This is right speech that is noble, a factor of the path. Again, the last factor there is an import from the last passage is an import from the Abhidhamma. One makes an effort to abandon wrong speech and to enter upon right speech. This is one's right effort. So the effort to be virtuous, basically. Mindfully one abandons wrong speech, mindfully one enters upon right speech. This is one's right mindfulness. One is clear about what one talks about, so one is mindful at all times. This is really the only way one can purify the virtue to the highest degree here. Thus, these three states run and circle around right speech, that is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. Right view distinguishes between what is right and what is wrong in terms of speech. Right effort abandons it, and right mindfulness keeps a watch over the mind and watch over the speech to make sure that we don't say the wrong thing. Then we come to action, the fourth factor of the path. There in bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong action as wrong action and right action as right action. That is one's right view. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong action? Killing living beings, taking what is not given, and misconduct in sensual pleasures. This is wrong action. And what, bhikkhus, is right action? Right action, I say, is twofold. There is right action that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. And there is right action that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. And what beggars is right action that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? Abstinence from the killing of living beings, abstinence from taking what is not given, abstinence from misconduct in sensual pleasures. That is right action that is affected by the taints, ripening in the acquisitions. And what beggars is right action that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The desisting from the three kinds of bodily misconduct, the abstaining, refraining, abstinence from them in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right action that is noble, a factor of the path. Again, word for word, as in the Abhidhamma Vibhanga. One makes an effort to abandon wrong action and to enter upon right action. That is one's right effort. Mindfully, one abandons wrong action. Mindfully, one enters upon and dwells in right action. That is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right action. That is right view, right effort, right mindfulness. Again, there, of course, right view distinguishes between right and wrong action. Right effort is the effort which moves you towards right action. And right mindfulness is what keeps it clear in your mind at all times how you are actually acting here. Okay, factor 5 of the Noble Eightfold Path is right livelihood. And therein, because right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong livelihood as wrong livelihood and right livelihood as right livelihood. This is one's right view. And what bickers is wrong livelihood? Scheming, talking, hinting, belittling, pursuing gain with gain. This is wrong livelihood. Okay, I'll just explain that in a little bit. Now, this is a type of livelihood that is mostly connected with monks. And it actually is extended quite a lot in some suttas. Some suttas actually talk a lot about wrong livelihood and right livelihood for monastic sangha, both monks and nuns. So anything which has to do with astrology and reading fortunes and using false weights and measures and all kind of basically acting as a doctor, for example, all these things are wrong livelihood for monastics. You shouldn't really be doing that according to the suttas. So if somebody comes and gives you alms food because you are reading their astrology for them, then that actually is wrong livelihood according to the suttas for the monastic sangha. And this here is just a shortened version really of that. So all these things, getting your alms food and your requisites because of these sort of actions, that is basically the wrong way of doing it for the monastic sangha. Now, right and wrong livelihood for lay people is usually considered quite differently. And there is a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is actually referred to in the notes by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi here. And right livelihood, or rather wrong livelihood for lay people is usually trade in meat, trade in animals, trade in weapons, trade in poisons, and I think also maybe trade in humans. I can't remember exactly now, but there is a reference there to the Anguttara Nikaya somewhere. Trade in alcohol, in meat, in living beings, in weapons, and in poisons. Those are, the five. So anything basically which is harmful for living beings, that is the wrong kind of livelihood, if you like, for non-monastic Buddhists. Okay, what bhikkhus is right livelihood? Right livelihood, I say, is twofold. There is right livelihood that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. And there is right livelihood that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. And what bhikkhus is right livelihood that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? Here bhikkhus, a noble disciple, abandons wrong livelihood and gains his living by right livelihood. This is right livelihood that is affected by the taints, ripening in acquisitions. So it doesn't say very much about what it is, but it's just those things I mentioned before, which you have to abandon. Yes, yeah, certainly. Yeah. I think it's the same thing, yeah. It's basically saying that it doesn't in itself lead out of samsara, but it leads to rebirth. That's the essentially what they're saying there. So ripening and acquisitions are usually understood as the five khandhas, right? Basically, your identity as a person, the five khandhas. Partaking of merit means that basically it's good karma, so it will lead to, you know, lead to a happy destination. Connected with the taints just means that, well, you haven't given up the asavas, you know, the taints, so which are basically deep-rooted defilements in the mind. So they're still connected with the taints. So basically, they are about the same thing, just different ways of saying the same thing. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And what bhikkhus is right livelihood that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The desisting from wrong livelihood, the abstaining, refraining, abstinence from it. In one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right livelihood that is noble, a factor of the path. Again, it's an Abhidhamma insertion there. One makes an effort to abandon wrong livelihood and to enter upon right livelihood. This is one's right effort. Mindfully, one abandons wrong livelihood. Mindfully, one enters upon and dwells in right livelihood. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right livelihood, that is, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. Okay, so that's the five factors. Now we come on to a slightly different part of the sutta here, which is quite short. Does anybody want to comment anything before we move on? We haven't got much time left, actually. Any questions? No? Okay, we'll just move on to the last part here. Okay, therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? In one of right view, right intention comes into being. So this is interesting and it's important because very often you find that the Noble Eightfold Path is explained as eight factors. Which don't necessarily have much to do with each other. They obviously condition each other, but they're not explained in any particular conditional relationship. But here is one of those suttas where it actually shows you that each factor of the Noble Eightfold Path conditions the next one. In other words, there's a natural sequence in the Noble Eightfold Path which goes from the first one, then goes sequentially from right view, conditioning the second, third, fourth, all the way down to the eighth factor, each factor conditioning the next one. And this sutta is one among a number which does that. It's actually important to realize this because it gives a very interesting reading, understanding of the Noble Eightfold Path, which you don't get if you just take them to be eight factors, like standalone factors, so to speak, which just are completely interrelated or not related at all. But that there is a sequence there, which is like the main sequence, is actually an important understanding of this path. And that's why you have, in one of right view, right intention comes into being. In other words, you have to have some degree of right view. The stronger that right view is, the more powerful your right intention becomes, until you have completely right view, and then your intention will tend to also to be completely right. So, then it goes on, in one of right intention, right speech comes into being. In one of right speech, right action comes into being. In one of right action, right livelihood comes into being. In one of right livelihood, right effort comes into being. In one of right effort, right mindfulness comes into being. And in one of right mindfulness, right concentration comes into being. In one of right concentration, right knowledge comes into being. In one of right knowledge, right deliverance comes into being. Thus, monks, the path of the disciple in higher training possesses eight factors. The arahant possesses 10 factors. I'm just briefly going to go through this because we don't have much time, but just to point out some interesting things here, which are are actually quite important as far as I'm concerned. Of course, from right intention, then you get right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And the reason for that is that when your intention is correct, then you will act on that intention. So if you have good and wholesome intentions, your actions will also tend, and your speech will also tend to be right and wholesome, right? So right intention is necessary for there to be right action and right speech. You can see how that is. So right view leads to right intention. Right intention leads to right morality, right virtue. I think it's quite obvious why that has to be the case. Then comes one which is maybe a little bit more obscure, and that is that from that right virtue, which ends with right livelihood, right effort comes into being. Now, why is that? And the reason for that is that normally right effort is understood to have to do with the mind. You want to purify your mind, right? You want to purify your mind of anger and greed and all these other negative things. Because the purification of mind is a more refined thing than the purification of the body and speech, it's only when you have actually purified your body and speech to a certain extent that it's possible to start purifying the mind. So that's why when right virtue is in place, then that gives rise to right effort, because right effort has to do with purification of the mind. Purification of mind can only happen when the more coarse purification has proceeded beforehand. Then you have, in one of right effort, right mindfulness comes into being. And again, this is interesting here, because what this means is that you have to, right effort, as I said, has to do with purification of the mind to a large extent. So it means that you can only have right mindfulness when the mind is quite pure. You have to take away, basically, all the coarse defilements out of the mind before right mindfulness is possible. Now, right mindfulness in the suttas is the four satipatthanas, right? The four areas where you direct that mindfulness. So before you can really do meditation practice, the four satipatthanas or right mindfulness are really meditation. Before you can even do that, your mind has to be quite pure beforehand. Otherwise, it's not going to work. So by developing right effort, that makes the four satipatthanas, it makes meditation possible, which is basically right mindfulness here. That is an important thing to notice here, that you have to be fairly pure in both your mental conduct as well, of course, as your verbal conduct and physical bodily conduct before you can meditate. And then he has, in one of right mindfulness, right concentration comes into being. Now, for me, this is very interesting, because this is it's quite different from how the path of meditation very often is described. Note here that mindfulness is a condition for right concentration. This is what it's saying here. Now, right mindfulness is the four satipatthanas, right concentration is the four jhanas. So what the sutta is saying is that to enter the four jhanas, you have to do the four satipatthanas. That's what it's saying here. And it's not the only place, it says so in many places. And that's interesting, because very often we find in the, many modern meditation teachers, they say that, well, you do vipassana practice, and vipassana practice is the same as satipatthana. These two things go together, and that's all you do. You shouldn't really worry so much. You don't have to worry about the jhanas. This is one of the refrains you can often hear from the vipassana teachers, although it's true it's changing somewhat these days, because people are getting more into samatha and jhanas around the world, but that's a very common refrain. But in fact, the purpose of satipatthana, the purpose of practicing it, is to attain the jhanas. And that's what it is saying here in the sutta. And to me, that is a very powerful statement, because it shows you that a lot of the reason, a lot of what satipatthana is about, it's about samatha, it's about calming the mind, it's about attaining samadhi, it's about becoming more pure in the mind. That's what it's about. And it's not about insight at this stage. It's actually moving towards the jhanas and samadhi. That is the purpose of satipatthana practice. So this idea that satipatthana is equivalent to vipassana, it's not correct. According to the suttas, satipatthana is also about samatha, also about calming. Yes, there is a vipassana aspect to satipatthana, but there is at least, I would say, a bigger aspect of samatha to satipatthana than there is vipassana. And that's what you can see from a small little statement like that. Right mindfulness brings up right concentration. And then we have in one of right concentration, right knowledge comes into being. Now, right knowledge, that this is the Pali term is here samma jnana, right knowledge. In other suttas, we find that right concentration leads to yata bhuta jnana dasana, knowledge and vision according to reality. So I understand samma jnana here to be basically synonymous with yata bhuta jnana dasana. It basically just means seeing reality as it actually is. In other words, seeing reality in terms of the three characteristics of suffering, of impermanence and non-self. That's essentially what it means. And of course, if you keep seeing the five khandhas and reality in terms of the three characteristics, then eventually you're going to become an arya. You're going to become a sotapanna and eventually an arahat. As you keep doing that again and again and again, you're going to see through the wrong views of self, permanence, and happiness. And then, in one of right knowledge, right deliverance comes into being, samma vimutti. Samma vimutti is the deliverance, or the liberation, if you like, of an arahat. It's the full and final liberation. So when you have right knowledge, then eventually that right deliverance will come into being. So, and then he says, the path of the disciple in higher training possesses eight factors. In other words, the first eight factors up to Samma Samadhi, that's possessed by the Sotapanna and by anybody who is not an arahant yet, but who is an arya. And the arahant, he is the one who possesses all factors, because for him, right knowledge and also right deliverance are perfected. So he has all 10 factors. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? In one of right view, wrong view is abolished, and the many evil unwholesome states that originate with wrong view as condition are also abolished. And the many wholesome states that originate with right view as condition come to fulfillment by development. Basically, right view is obviously very something you want to have, because it gives rise to all these good things. In one of right intention, wrong intention is abolished, and the many bad, unwholesome states that originate with wrong intention as condition are also abolished. And the many wholesome states that originate with right intention as condition come to fulfillment by development. And then the same thing is repeated for all these 10 factors. In one of right speech, wrong speech is abolished. In one of right action, wrong action is abolished. In one of right livelihood, wrong livelihood is abolished. In one of right effort, wrong effort is abolished. In one of right mindfulness, wrong mindfulness is abolished. In one of right concentration, wrong concentration is abolished. In one of right knowledge, wrong knowledge is abolished. In one of right deliverance, wrong deliverance is abolished. And the many evil, unwholesome states that originate with wrong deliverance as condition are also abolished. And the many wholesome states that originate with right deliverance as condition come to fulfillment by development. Thus, monks, there are 20 factors on the side of the wholesome. These 20 factors are the 10 factors of the path from right view to right deliverance, plus the 10 types of wholesome states that originate with each one of these other factors. That gives you 20. And 20 factors on the side of the unwholesome. So this is all the wrong factors and all the things which arise from the wrong factors. This Dhamma discourse on the great 40 has been set rolling and cannot be stopped by any recluse or Brahmin or God or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world. That statement there is very similar to the statement which is used for the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which was the first sutta the Buddha taught. So this is basically, because it was used for the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and it's used here again, this is to signify that this discourse is an important one, basically. That's the significance there, that it has been set rolling and cannot be stopped. Because if any recluse or Brahmin thinks that this Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 should be censured and rejected, then there are 10 legitimate deductions from his assertions that would provide grounds for censuring him here and now. If that worthy one censures right view, then he would honor and praise those recluses and Brahmins who are of wrong view. If that worthy one censures right intention, then he would honor and praise those recluses and Brahmins who are of wrong intention. If that worthy one censures right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right knowledge, right deliverance, then he would honor and praise those recluses and Brahmins who are of wrong deliverance. If any recluse or Brahmin thinks that this Dhamma discourse on the great fortress should be censured and rejected, then these are 10 legitimate deductions from his assertions that will provide grounds for censuring him here and now. In other words, if you take the side of somebody who censures all these things, then you yourself will become censured for that. Because even those teachers from Okkala, Vassa, and Banya, I don't know where these places are, but somewhere in India, who held the doctrine of non-causality, the doctrine of non-doing, the doctrine of nihilism, would not think that this Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 should be censured and rejected. Why is that? For fear of blame, attack, and confutation. Because the point here is that these teachers of Okkala, Vassa, and Banya, they have doctrines of non-causality, doctrines of non-doing, and doctrines of nihilism. Basically, they don't believe in karma and rebirth. That's what it means. So because they don't believe in karma and rebirth, they have basically got wrong view, and they probably have got wrong all the factors on this path. But they still don't reject this discourse because they are afraid of blame and attack, etc. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Any more questions? Comments? Yeah.
When you stay in this a month, on what you said today, because you've got the benefit of an intense study of the two chapters of the word.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that. Yeah.
And what you're saying is that, it's not always, it's a strong influencing part by the Abhidharma.
It's not really. This is a very, very rare case. I should say that, very, very rare case. It happens extremely rarely. Yeah, and that's why, because the suttas are very consistent usually. Huh? So that's why I said this is the only place in the suttas where actually this particular paragraph is found, for example. Huh? And then so. Well, I used to be much more literalist. I used to think that what's in the suttas is the word of the Buddha, and I was very fascinated when I found out that actually that's not the case. I started reading historical studies, for example. One of the things you find out when you read historical analysis of the suttas is that, first of all, that there is a vast distinction between when the various things were written. Okay, the suttas of the four main Nikayas, they are all generally accepted to go back to the time of the Buddha. But most people accept that the Abhidhamma, for example, was written about 200 or 300 years, the main part of it, after the Buddha. So a lot of it will not be the word of the Buddha, it will be the word of somebody else, right? The core of it may have come from the Buddha, but the expansion of it will have come from somewhere else. And this is actually a very important point, because we don't know. It's possible that the Abhidhamma is correct. What is an Abhidhamma? It may very well be right. It's a different system from the suttas. It's not really compatible with the suttas. So it's not right to reject it and say it's all wrong. That's the wrong attitude to take. But the point is not that we should reject it. The point is that we should say we don't know who wrote it. We don't know whether it's right or correct. So we can just put it to one side and forget about it. We don't really have to make up, we don't have to decide whether it's right or wrong. We can just say that, well, it's not, if it is not the word of the Buddha, or at least we can't be sure it is the word of the Buddha, then we should put it to one side, put a question mark against it, and not really take it into account when we read the suttas. That's the important thing here. And it's the same thing with the commentaries. You don't have to make any hard and fast rules. I reject it all. Because that's also going too far. Because there's a lot of good stuff in the commentaries, a lot of useful things. And some of the early scholars who started reading the suttas, they had to use the commentaries to understand the content. Otherwise, they couldn't do it. So just don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, you know. But be careful. Put a question mark against it and use the material with great care, only when you feel confident that it actually is telling the truth. And that's why it is so nice now that we have scholars who can read both Chinese, they can read Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan, they can compare all the various sources. And then when you compare the sources, you can see, generally speaking, what is the same, the core, which is similar in all of them. And what you find, one of the wonderful things that you actually find when you do that, is that you find that the similarities far, far, far outweigh the differences in the suttas. So you compare the Chinese with the Pali, and remember that these parted ways about 2,200 years ago, right? It's a long, long time ago. And even after 2,200 years, they're pretty much identical. That's quite remarkable, isn't it? And that, for me, gives incredible strong faith that what we read in the suttas is basically the word of the Buddha, because it has been so well preserved over 2,200 years. Then there's only another 200 or 300 years, and you went back to the time of the Buddha. You can be pretty sure that what you're reading in these suttas is the word of the Buddha. But you still have to investigate and be careful, because occasionally there will be things like paragraphs which have been inserted or whatever. Well, the suttas, generally they accepted that they were spoken by one person, which is the Buddha himself. But the actual writing down of the suttas only happened about, the actual writing down, usually it's considered to be the first century BC, that they were written down in Sri Lanka. 400 years probably, 300-400 years. So before that it was oral tradition basically. Right, yeah. I don't think he said it was only two. What he said was that Dhammanupassana, which is the last Satipatthana, and the last one in the Pali has, you have the Satipatthana on the five hindrances, you have the one on the Four Noble Truths, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, and the seven enlightenment factors. There's five different factors to the last one. I think he said that the only ones that he thinks are original is the one on the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. The three others he thinks have been inserted later on. On the first Satipatthana, body contemplation, I think the only one which he took to be original, or the most likely one to be original, was the body contemplation. All the rest he reckons may have been added. No, the body contemplation, the 36 parts of the body. Two parts of the body, sorry, and the reason for that is his study is also, that's also a very interesting study, is that taking all the various sources of Satipatthana, comparing them all together, and look what they have in common. What they don't have in common, discard, and see what you're left with. And there's very, very little. Well, you still have the four Satipatthanas, but the first one, if I remember correctly, is only left with... I think it's only left with the 32 parts of the body here. But don't quote me on that one, because I can't remember very clear on that one. But for the feet... Sorry? I don't think that... I can't remember. I can't remember clearly on that one. But the second and the third Satipatthana, that's pretty much as it is, because that's a fairly... it's a sort of very contained part. Satipatthana on feeling and the mind is only one aspect to it, really, anyway. And the last Satipatthana, he was arguing, is only the hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. And it's one of the interesting things which come of that, if you do that, because the last Satipatthana, which is Dhammanupassana, you take away the contemplation of the five aggregates, the six sense bases, and the Four Noble Truths. Now those three are the three aspects which have most to do with insight, right? So you take those away, you're left with the five hindrances and the seven bhujangas. Now those are things which have to do with samatha practice, with samadhi practice. So those things which, one of his arguments that the actual original Satipatthana Sutta, which you may call it if you can call it that, actually was a much more Samatha Samadhi based sutta than the one we have today, which he reckons has been, you know, changed into what it is now. And there is a lot of evidence that Satipatthana Sutta has been changed. I mean, even recently it has been changed, for example. And there is one very clear case that there's two Satipatthana Sutras, the Maha Satipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya and the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Now, the Maha Satipatthana Sutta is actually longer than the Satipatthana Sutta. It has a long section on the Four Noble Truths, which is not found in the Satipatthana Sutta. And yet, some editors in some places have started replacing the shorter Satipatthana Sutta with the longer one. So then the longer one appears in both places, right? And when you see that these sort of things are already happening to this day, and this was quite recent that this happened, maybe 100 years ago or something, then it's very easy to see how it could have happened before as well, you know? People are saying, well, this is the word of the Buddha, this is the word, we just put in a bit more of the word of the Buddha, right? So what's wrong with that? Well, the problem with that is that you actually are, even though you are putting in the word of the Buddha, it has to do with context as well. What is the context? How does it all fit together? So you may think that you're not doing anything wrong, but in fact, you know, there is actually distortion happening there as you do that. And that is the problem. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It came through for me as well, but I think it was a bit artificial, because I think that everybody was trying to be friendly, and people weren't really touching on the things that were really controversial. So it was a bit artificial. I felt it wasn't really. I mean, if you really had gotten down to it, you probably would have found much more differences there. But fair enough. I think the most important thing is that. All traditions, you know, whether even the Tibetans and the Mahayana and the Theravada, there is a core teaching there which is very similar to all of them. So if people actually go back to those core teachings, then the practice will be very similar. The problem is that in most traditions, people don't look to the core. They look to all the other material which has come later on. Most Theravadins, they will look to Abhidhamma, they will look to Visuddhimagga, they will look to commentaries, and they will decide, well, this is how we understand the word of the Buddha through these other books. The Mahayanas will have their own sutras, which they will understand the teaching of the Buddha through. And that's why you get so much argument, because everybody is using these other sutras as their guide, rather than going back to the core teachings. Okay, so I would pay our respects to the Triple Gem.
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sanghang Namami.